our feelings are very fluctuating and ephemeral, aren't they? But dwelling on the faithfulness and the love and the mercy of God is always safe. Welcome to Gateway to Joy, a ministry of challenge and commitment. Here's your friend, Elizabeth Elliott.
You are loved with an everlasting love. That's what the Bible says. And underneath are the everlasting arms. This is your friend, Elizabeth Elliott, continuing to read today from Elizabeth Prentice's book, Stepping Heavenward. It's the diary of a young girl. She has just gotten married. She has just come back from the honeymoon. And she confesses to her diary that the honeymoon didn't have quite as much honey in it as she had hoped. And she's quite upset to discover that her husband, who happens to be a doctor, is very busy, that the doorbell rings and he has to leave just when they've sat down to have a nice quiet time together in the living room. Every event in a Christian's life is intended to provide one more step heavenward, one more opportunity to be conformed to the image of Christ, to be like him, to follow him, as he followed the will of his Father while here on earth. Jesus got tired, needed to sleep, and eat and drink and walk from point A to point B. He was loved by some, hated by many, argued with, reviled, despised, rejected, a man of sorrows and familiar with suffering. He's still familiar with your suffering today, able to identify far more intimately than anyone else in your life. Jesus had to learn obedience by the things that he suffered. We had a glimpse of the last day of the honeymoon. I will read some more from her diary. Mrs. Embry has been here today. I longed to compare notes with her and find out whether it really is my fault that I'm not quite happy. But I could not bear to open my heart to her on so sacred a subject. We had some general conversation, however, which did me good for the time, at least. She said she thought one of the first lessons a wife should learn is self-forgetfulness. I wondered if she had seen anything in me to call forth this remark. We meet pretty often, partly because our husbands are such good friends, partly because she is as fond of music as I am, and we like to sing and play together, and I never see her that she does not do or say something elevating, something that strengthens my own best purposes and desires. But she knows nothing of my conflict and dismay, and never will. Her gentle nature responds at once to holy influences. I truly feel grateful to her for loving me, for she really does love me. And yet she must see my faults. I should like to know if there is any reason on earth why a woman should learn self-forgetfulness that does not apply to a man. I think we need to ponder that one, don't we, my radio listeners? Self-forgetfulness, perhaps the most important issue for a newlywed. Well, I'll skip over some more. February 28th, Katie's diary says, such a dreadful thing is going to happen. I have cried and called myself names by turns all day. Ernest writes, it has been decided to give up the old homestead and scatter the family about among the married sons and daughters. Our share is to be his father and his sister Martha, and he desires me to have two rooms got ready for them at once. So all the glory and the beauty is snatched out of my married life at one swoop, and it is done by the hand I love best, and that I would not have believed could be so unkind. I am torn in pieces by conflicting emotions and passions. One moment I'm all tenderness and sympathy for poor Ernest, and ready to sacrifice everything for his pleasure. The next, I am bitterly angry with him for disposing of all my happiness in this arbitrary way. If he had let me make common cause with him and share his interests with him, I know I am not so abominably selfish as to feel as I do now. But he forces two perfect strangers upon me and forever shuts our doors against my darling mother. For, of course, she cannot live with us if they do. and who knows what sort of people they are. It's not everybody I can get along with, nor is it everybody that can get along with me. Now, if Helen were coming instead of Martha, that would be some relief. I could love her, I'm sure, and she would put up with my ways. But your Marthas, I am afraid of. Oh, dear, dear, what a nest of scorpions this affair has stirred up within me. Who would believe I could be thinking of my own misery while Ernest's mother, whom he loved so dearly, is hardly in her grave? But I have no heart. I am stony and cold. It's well to have found out just what I am. Since I wrote that, I have been trying to tell God all about it. But I could not speak for crying, and I have been getting the rooms ready. How many little things I had planned to put in the best one, which I intended for Mother. I have made myself arrange them just the same for Ernest's father. The stuffed chair I've had in my room and enjoyed so much has been rolled in, and the Bible with large print placed on a little table near which I had pictured Mother with her sweet, pale face as sitting year after year. The only thing I have taken away is the copy of Father's portrait. He won't want that. When I had finished this business, I went and shook my fist at the creature I saw in the glass. "You're beaten," I cried. "You didn't want to give up the chair, nor your writing table, nor the Bible in which you expect to record the names of your 10 children. But you've had to do it, so there." March 3rd. They all got here at 7 o'clock last night, just in time for tea. I was so glad to get hold of Ernest once more that I was gracious to my guests, too. The very first thing, however, Ernest annoyed me by calling me Catherine, though he knows I hate that name, and I want to be called Katie as if I were a lovable person, as I certainly am, sometimes. Of course, his father and his Martha called me Catherine, too. His father is even taller, darker, blacker-eyed, and blacker-haired than he. Martha is a spinster. I had got up a nice little supper for them, thinking they would need something substantial after their journey, and perhaps there was some vanity in the display of dainties that needed the mortification I felt at seeing my guests both push away their plates in apparent disgust. Ernest, too, looked annoyed and expressed some regret that they could find nothing to tempt their appetites. Martha said something about not expecting much from young housekeepers, which I inwardly resented, for the light, delicious bread had been sent by Auntie, together with other luxuries from her own table, and I knew they were not the handiwork of a young housekeeper, but of old Chloe, who had lived with my aunt and her mother's family for 20 years. Ernest went out as soon as this unlucky repast was over, to hear Dr. Embury's report of his patients. And we passed a dreary evening as my mind was preoccupied with longing for his return. The more I tried to think of something to say, the more I couldn't. At last Martha asked at what time we breakfasted. "At 7:30 precisely," I answered. "Ernest is very punctual about breakfast. The other meals are more irregular." "That is very late," she returned. "Father rises early and needs his breakfast at once." I said I would see that he had it as early as he liked, while I foresaw that this would cost me a battle with the divinity who reigned in the kitchen. "You need not trouble yourself. I will speak to my brother about it," she said. "Ernest has nothing to do with it," I said quickly. She looked at me in speechless dismay, and then there was a long silence, during which she shook her head a number of times. At last she inquired, "Did you make the bread we had on the table tonight?" "No, I do not know how to make bread," I said, smiling at her look of horror. "Not know how to make bread?" she cried. The very spirit of mischief got into me and made me ask, "Why, can you?" Now I know that there is but one other question I could have asked her, less insulting than this, and that is, "Do you know the 10 Commandments? A spinster fresh from a farm? Not know how to make bread? To be sure." But in a moment I was ashamed, and sorry that I had yielded to myself so far as to forget the courtesy due to her as my guest, and one just come from a scene of sorrow. So I rushed across the room, seized her hand, and said eagerly, "Do forgive me. It slipped out before I thought." She looked at me in blank amazement, unconscious that there was anything to forgive. "How you startled me," she said. "I thought you had suddenly gone crazy." I went back to my seat, crestfallen enough. All this time, Ernest's father had sat grim and grave in his corner without a word. Now he spoke. "At what hour does my son have family worship? I should like to retire. I feel very weary." Now, family worship at night consists in our kneeling down together, hand in hand, the last thing before going to bed, and in our own room. The awful thought of changing this sweet, informal habit into a formal one made me reply quickly, "Oh, Ernest is very irregular about it. He's often out in the evening, and sometimes we are up quite late. I hope you will never feel obliged to wait for him." "I trust I shall do my duty, whatever it costs," was the answer. Oh, how I wished they would go to bed. And I'll read some more tomorrow from Stepping Heavenward.
As Elizabeth has said, anything if offered to God can and will become your gateway to joy. Elizabeth Elliot has been sharing timeless truth with ladies for many years, drawing insight from her Bible study and her experiences as a wife, mother, and missionary. Join us next time for more encouragement and challenge from Elizabeth Elliot. This has been a production of the Bible Broadcasting Network, Charlotte, North Carolina.